Hillary Adam, before Bill gets his presentation started, I have a short PowerPoint that just sort of touches on some of the points I noted in the memo.
Thanks, Hillary.
That I handed to you last week and placed a new copy in front of you just now. Okay. So quickly, I don't know if Bill has this in his presentation, but this is a map of the multi-dwelling zones where this revised code would apply. I noted some basic changes in the new proposed code, such as regulating development intensity by FAR rather than number of units. The image on the right shows in a smaller site, you could get a lot more units in previously than you can under the current code, which shows 18 units or one unit per 1,000. So the new code would regulate by mass and scale rather than number of units. It splits the RH zone into two zones. The RH zone is currently a 2-to-1 and a 4-to-1 FAR in different sections, so it just simplifies that. It allows transfers of FAR from preservation of trees and existing affordable housing that's documented with Portland Housing Bureau, and now from contributing resources in historic and conservation districts, and also does not allow transfer of FAR into historic districts through this code section. It simplifies the setback regulations. Currently, we determine the side and rear setbacks by the area of the building wall. This would break that up into just two categories. If the building's less than 55 feet tall, it'd be a 5-foot setback at the side and rear. And if it's more than 55 feet, it would be 10, unless it's on a street lot line. Requires front setbacks to reflect neighborhood patterns, limits number of stairs above grade on street-facing facades that is referenced in that image there on the left. Requires step-downs to single-dwelling zones, matching height limits to those zones. Allows for small-scale commercial uses on more intensely used corridors, such as neighborhood corridors, civic corridors. It prioritizes affordable housing with bonuses, as shown in that chart there. And it requires large street-facing facades to be divided into smaller parts if they're over 100 feet long. This is a topic that's come up frequently with you guys regarding what's the proper step up and step back for residential units at the ground level. The new code would require that 20% of new units be visible, and that means that no more than one stair between the nearest street and entrance could be placed for accessibility. One of the things I mentioned in my memo was whether or not there should be a secondary access point. And then some other sections requires main entrances to face the street. So in that blue building there, that would require main entrance, limit surface parking and street facing garages. And then in East Portland, it requires deeper rear yard setbacks. That's mostly to help preserve large stands of Douglas fir trees that are found out there in the deeper lots. It would also require a minimum street frontage of 90 feet to allow for development of streets and partial streets so that we could get better connectivity out in East Portland. One of the things that we've talked about a little bit at the staff level is ensuring that, you know, if partial streets are created, that those have the same regulations requiring main entrances and limiting surface street-facing garages, so that you don't end up with this situation on the right here on a partial street that may someday connect through. So those are just the issues that I wanted to highlight for you before Bill gets started.
Quick question.
Yeah.
What is the boundary of East Portland?
I have a map.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I couldn't. So it's east of 205.
Does everybody have a microphone turned on and close enough to them that it's being picked up?
I think so.
You can turn everybody's mic off if you want.
Thank you. Are we ready to go? Thanks, Hillary. And I am Bill Cunningham with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, project manager for the update to our multi-dwelling zoning code, which we're calling the Better Housing by Design project. And let's see, just want to make sure I get this presentation up where it should be. Oh, okay. I'll have a bit more detail than Hillary provided, and my main points today is to give you a little heads up as to what we have proposed for zoning code amendments to the multi-dwelling zones, and give you at least an initial opportunity to ask any questions and offer any comments. We are in our initial public review period of our first discussion draft, so it'll be a while before it goes to a Planning and Sustainability Commission. I should mention that with this update to the multi-dwelling zone code, it's really focused on multi-dwelling zones outside the central city, since central city has been the focus of its own effort. It's probably the most significant change or rewrite to the multi-dwelling zoning code over the last 25 years. So I'd encourage you to pay attention to what we're proposing, because it will probably be shaping some of the projects that go before you outside the central city. One other thing I should mention, while I'm highlighting the zoning code amendments, we've also partnered with the Bureau of Transportation. When we're looking at development issues in the multi-dwelling zones in East Portland, for example, part of the issue with improving development outcomes is not only the design of the site, but trying to encourage more street connections or facilitate more street connections to get to our connectivity goals. One thing that's been confusing to some community members is the fact that we've been doing a lot of zoning code updates. And a couple years ago, we did update to our mixed use zones, and we're currently also updating our single family zones through the residential infill project. And now the Better Housing by Design project is basically addressing all the rest of the areas that allow residential development, the multi-dwelling zones. And the scale of development allowed in those zones are pretty broad, from zones where it's primarily duplexes to zones allowing up to 10 stories of height. You're all aware of our growth strategies about focusing housing growth in and around centers and corridors. This map is showing the relationship between our mixed use zones and our multifamily zones. They're really intended to work in conjunction with each other, with the blue multi-dwelling zones typically in pretty close proximity to our centers and corridors, so typically fairly close to transit. You'll also notice that the multi-dwelling zones are less tightly drawn around the corridors. They often go further into neighborhood areas or side streets, including in the J District, the whole area between Division and Powell. It's about 10% of the land's area, the city's land area, but about 25% of the city's growth is expected in those areas. I'm not going to go into detail, but we recently updated our comprehensive plan, as you know, and of course our comprehensive plan calls for a lot of various things: housing diversity, better street environments that support pedestrian orientation, things about street connectivity. There's often a gap between these aspirations and what gets built and the way our regulations work. A key goal is to really try to narrow that gap between our aspirations and what's happening and the way our regulations are set up. In July of 2017, we released a concept report, which is basically highlighting ideas for improving the multi-dwelling zones. And this was a result of sorting through our comprehensive plan policies, community discussion, and actually also past projects that identified needed improvements. And our discussion draft is our first public release of draft code language. And the discussion period and comment period is through March 19th, after which we'd be going into a proposed draft, which we hope to be available in May. And then we'll be going to the Planning and Sustainability Commission in June of this year. I believe you are provided copies of Volume 1, the staff report. It's about a 40-page, fairly a short read. If you're really interested in learning more about our proposals, I'd really encourage you to take a look at this document. It has a bit more discussion than what you have in the 8-page handout and hits on most of the major proposals. If you want to look at all the details, you'll find the specific zoning code language in Volume 2, which is about 200 pages. We have a pretty broad array of proposals. I mean, we try to group them into a smaller number of topic areas to keep things a little bit more legible. We have a number of proposals related to housing diversity and affordability, some others related to outdoor spaces and green elements, some related to building design and scale, and then several other proposals focusing on East Portland and related street connectivity issues. That first topic area, housing diversity and affordability. I should mention that the majority of our multi-dwelling zones are sort of a medium density scale, fairly low rise, not so different from some of the middle housing that's been a big point of discussion over the last couple of years. And clearly, when you look at the middle housing, historically, it's been a pretty vast, diverse array of housing that happens at that 2 to 3 story scale. You know, plexes, courtyard apartments, townhouses. And one thing we did in our project was to take a look at some historic examples of middle housing. And it's an especially rich assortment since prior to 1959, about 2/3 of the city's residential land allowed apartments. And fairly interesting to start looking at what was built and whether they could even be built in today's multi-dwelling zones. We did an analysis where we took a look at our zoning code standards in various zones and what is out there. And our R2 zone, which is intended to be a 2 to 3 story scale zone, it was interesting to find out that of these projects, all within a 2 at most 3 story scale, only the duplex of these examples could be built in the R2 zone. If you wanted to do a fourplex or a small lot duplex, you need to move up to the R1 zone. These courtyard apartments could only be built in our RH zone, which is something like 5% of the city's multifamily zoning. So it's fairly limited because of our density-based approach. So a major change, and I'd really say this is probably our most significant change, is moving a proposal to move from regulating by unit density to regulating by the size of the building. And this slide is showing the contrast between our current approach, where in the R2 zone, the density maximum is 1 unit per 2,000 square feet of site area. On a standard 5,000 square foot lot, that means 2 units maximum. Allows a fair amount of scale, 40 feet of height, so you can do very large row house or townhouse units. And in our closer neighborhoods, those are usually selling for $650,000 or more. So not a whole lot of housing diversity, and there are some implications for cost. What we're proposing to do is to establish a maximum building size, which we're describing by floor area ratio. And in the R2 zone, we're proposing a 1-to-1 FAR, which would mean 5,000 square feet of building area on a 5,000 square foot lot. And rather than limiting it to 2, we would allow a mix of different approaches in that envelope. It could be a duplex or a triplex or a fourplex or something else. And the intent is to bring back allowances for some of that diversity we used to have in our low-rise zones. Something we're also proposing, however, is with that greater density or numbers of units, we're looking at requiring that 20% of units be designed to be visitable so that at least one level of the unit is accessible to wheelchairs, wider hallways, a large enough bathroom space to accommodate maneuvering. And but there is a difference, of course, between visitable and fully accessible, in that you could still do two-level units. You just need to have one level be accessible.
Hey, Bill, is it okay if we ask questions as you move through rather than saving them for the end? What is your preference?
Part of it might have to do with time management. I think I've half an hour. Maybe clarifying questions would be good, and maybe discussion-type questions for afterwards.
Okay, very well. So I have a clarifying question. The requirement for visitable units, is there a minimum number of units in the development proposed before that becomes a requirement?
It's based on density. So if you're doing that pair of townhouse units, it would not be required. But if you're exceeding that one unit per 2,000 square foot density, like for a triplex or fourplex, the expectation would be that one of those units would need to be visitable.
Huh. Okay. And see. Okay.
This is one where we're in discussions with the city attorney's office because there are state limitations on local preemption of building code requirements, and we're trying to sort that one out as to whether this is overlapping too much with building code requirements. We're providing an exception for buildings that are required by the Oregon Specialty Structurally Code to have accessible or adaptable units. So we're looking at only applying to this to unit types that aren't required currently to have accessible units. It's like single family types or townhouses.
Okay.
We're proposing something similar in the R1 zone, which is our most commonly mapped zone on corridors. It's a 45-foot height, four-story allowance zone, similar to most of our mixed-use zones and corridors. But in that zone, like others, it's regulated by unit count. And this is, as Hillary showed, an interesting pair of images. They're both three-story buildings, one built in the 1920s, one built just in the last couple of years. With one unit per 1,000 square feet of site area is the current maximum density. The 1920s example is three times the density that's allowed in the zone. And the modern one, similar scale, but they're all three-story townhouse units. One thing we've heard from designers and builders is that it's far easier to develop multifamily development in the commercial zones than it is to develop it in comparable multifamily zones. And so we have some interest in trying to address that imbalance. This is just an image showing the current unit-based approach on the left and something that's defining it more by the size of the building with more flexibility in units. As a result of our moving from the density approach, we're looking at renaming the zones. R2 stands for residential 2000, which wouldn't make so much sense moving to the scale approach. So we're looking at naming conventions that are more similar to the mixed-use zones, where a small number is a smaller scale zone and larger number is a larger scale zone. As a RM1 replaces both R2 and R3 zone, we'd be combining those. They're both intended to be fairly compatible with single-family type areas. RM2 is the replacement to R1, then RH, which currently has two different FARs and different related development standards, we're splitting into two separate zones for simplicity. We're also establishing a base FAR and a bonus FAR for each. It's a base, of course, being by right, and bonus would be achievable by including some community benefits or public benefits such as affordable housing and also allowances for transfers of development rights within that scale, and I'll detail that a little bit more. One other thing we're doing that's related to your work is for the former RH zoning, we're proposing to expand the design overlay to all properties with that zoning, and that zoning allows scale of between 6 to 10 stories, and this is to be consistent to our approaches in the mixed-use zones. This map is showing, it's hard to make it out, but the gray is showing areas that are in the D overlay that are in the RH zone. Hatching is showing historic districts. And the dark red are the remaining areas that don't currently have the D overlay and are not in historic districts. About 84% of our RH zoning already is within the D overlay or historic districts. So this would be expanding it to the remaining 14%. And they're fairly scattered, but usually near the edges of the central city. There are areas at the edge of the Lloyd District and in the Kearns neighborhood, just beyond 12th or 15th, and some other areas just outside the central city to the southwest. So that would, and returning to the topic of what gets you to the bonus FAR, and the bonus FAR is equivalent to a 50% increase beyond the base FAR. And there's a purposeful gap between the scale of the by right FAR and the bonus. The intention is to make it fairly attractive to gain that additional scale. So that's clearly still very attractive to do something along the lines of this RM2 four-story scale, but you need to do something to get there. The things that would get you to that 50% bonus include, for one, inclusionary housing, whether it's mandatory for buildings with 20 more units or voluntary. We're increasing this to a 50% bonus versus the current 25% bonus. This would be more in line with what the mixed-use zones provide, which are closer to 60%. We're also proposing a moderate income family housing bonus, where if you're doing a project with at least half the units with three bedrooms and affordable at 100% of median family income, you could gain a 25% bonus. We have a current three bedroom bonus, but some concerns raised is that it has no linkage to affordability, and there's some concerns about giving a bonus scale to $850,000 townhouse units. There is a need for moderate income housing, especially in areas close to services. Another way to get to that 50% is through FAR transfers. One is our current historic resources transfer opportunity, which we're also expanding to make properties in historic districts that are contributing structures could transfer. We have two new ones. One is about preservation of existing affordable housing. And this would be a situation where you might have a two-story older affordable housing development in a four-story zone, and this would allow some of that unused development capacity to be transferred as an incentive for that preservation. And we're also proposing a tree preservation bonus. Currently, we have a tree preservation bonus that gives you additional units on the same site where you're preserving the trees, but that bonus has only been used twice in the last 10 years, partially because, especially at higher densities, getting more units on the same site where you're having a set aside space for trees is pretty difficult. So we're turning that into a FAR transfer provision instead of a on-site bonus. We also have a third bonus, which would provide 100% additional FAR and some additional height and lot coverage for developments which have a deeper level of housing affordability than inclusionary housing provides. To be eligible for this, projects would need to have at least half the units affordable at 60% of median family income. So that compares to the inclusionary housing 20% at 80% of median family income. And we don't expect this to be used much by private sector developers. It'd probably primarily be used by nonprofit affordable housing developers and would allow more maximization of those housing opportunities. A key thing to be aware of is that we're proposing to not allow the transfers, FAR transfers, to go into an historic district. And that would be consistent with what mixed-use zones that project did. And also the special 100% bonus FAR and additional height for the deeper housing affordability would not be allowed in an historic district out of concerns of some of the compatibility issues in those areas. However, inclusionary housing, that bonus we are proposing to make available in historic districts, as well as that moderate income family housing bonus. This is different from what the mixed-use zones did. Currently, you would not, in the mixed-use zones, be allowed to use the inclusionary housing bonus in an historic district. But internally, we made the decision, especially because inclusionary housing is mandatory in many cases, to make that available within historic districts. A major proposal.
I have a clarifying question. Sure. Is that also the height is tied to the FAR? So it's directly tied? Because I don't, as you talk about FAR, there is a height increase too in your previous slide.
There's actually no height increase. It's just that
that is the height
additional
increase.
Okay. The dashed square is basically the base zone development parameters, and you're able to fill that box up a bit more with the bonus FAR. But the height and lot coverage would stay the same generally with most bonuses, except for the deeper housing affordability bonus, which would give you more scale.
And do you have enough height to use the FAR in most cases, or in all cases?
You would, yes. We have an Appendix B that in which we had a code modeling done to look at the way our different development standards and FAR work to make sure they all fit together. And that analysis indicated that the basic 50% bonus would accommodate the FAR as allowed. A 100% bonus would not be accommodated within the usual height limit, so that's where we'd need to provide a bit more. One thing I should mention too is that that additional scale may not be as useful in the most intense zones, which already by right allow quite a bit of scale, but 90% of our land area with multi-dwelling zoning is in these first two RM1 and RM2 zones, where going to a 4 or 5 story scale is still a fairly feasible sort of a proposition. So I was going to mention on major corridors, we're proposing to allow limited amounts of commercial uses and daycare uses for sites that are directly on the big corridors. This came out of community discussions, especially in East Portland, where there's concern about the interface between residential units right along these very busy streets, where currently most of our zones have no allowance to include commercial. There's also community interest in live-work type arrangements where you could have that high visibility location actually become a bit of a positive if you allowed some provision for a small business. In East Portland especially, light rail stations that have multifamily zoning were seen as places where, if anything, we should encourage commercial uses. So we are proposing to allow by right small amounts of commercial uses in both the big corridors and the close to light rail stations. You would not, as in the mixed-use zones, be able to do a purely commercial development. You couldn't do a McDonald's or a Rite Aid. You would have to meet the minimum density requirements. So it'd typically have to be in conjunction with residential. These are some examples of some small commercial spaces. The left one was fairly organic. These are row houses built on a division past 82nd, which fairly quickly were converted to small commercial spaces. They're all small Asian businesses. We have another grouping of proposals related to outdoor spaces and green elements, and this followed from past efforts we had where we the Bureau worked with community partners to talk to tenants about what were important features in multifamily development. Outdoor spaces, especially for families with children, were seen as pretty key. Currently in the RH zone, we have no outdoor space requirement. We're proposing to use the same approach we recently adopted for the mixed-use zones, where for smaller sites up to 20,000 square feet, we'd require 36 square feet of outdoor space per unit and 48 square feet for larger sites. And that could either be private outdoor space or combined into common areas. And this is another thing that's addressing East Portland concerns, where we've been hearing that parking lots are often the only place for children to play. These two examples, I should mention, are both in the RH zone in the D overlay. So they're subject to our design standards, I believe, but maybe not the best outcomes. For larger sites, more than 20,000 square feet, we're also proposing a requirement that an area equivalent to 10% of the site area be devoted to common area, half of which could be indoor common area. That graphic is depicting that 10%, and the examples are right about 10%. And that outdoor space would not have to be at ground level. It could be in a raised area or a rooftop area. And again, a half of it could be indoors.
Why allow the indoor common area?
It related to a lot of community discussion we had was about family housing and the topic of the bad weather. And many felt we should provide allowances where indoor community spaces could count towards some of our usual residential recreation outdoor space requirements. So it was intended to be provide some flexibility. Another topic we heard too was at higher densities, it could be hard to find site area for outdoor space. You lose all that vertical opportunity. And so there was some interest in and allowing, again, indoor community spaces to count towards that. But any thoughts you might have in this or any other proposal, we'd definitely like to hear. Another proposal relates to landscaping. Currently, all our landscaping, required landscaping, must be in ground at ground level in the multi-dwelling zones. And we're proposing to allow some other forms, such as eco-roofs and raised courtyards, raised stormwater planters, to meet up to half of the required landscaping. We've had a proposal come in where they're doing a raised courtyard with landscaping and eco-roofs and everything, and none of that was able to count towards landscaping requirements, which are 30% in some cases in the multi-dwelling zones. So this is intended to provide more flexibility. Related to creating better site design too, we are proposing to change our parking requirements. 40% of our multi-dwelling zone is outside of our frequent transit buffer. So currently require one parking space per unit. The multi-dwelling zones though are usually within walking distance of corridors and centers. The image on the left is showing an example that meets that current one space per unit ratio. And in areas like East Portland where they don't do a lot of structured parking, that means surface parking, which takes up a lot of site area. We're proposing to change the ratio to one space per two units. In all the multi-dwelling zones. We actually currently have that in the RH zone, but we're looking at expanding to all the multi-dwelling zones so that you're not pushed to devote so much space to parking. For small sites, up to 7,500 square feet, we're proposing to drop parking requirements for up to 30 units. This is something we adopted as part of the mixed-use zones, and we're thinking it makes some sense here, especially when it's related to compact development, like middle housing on those small sites. Putting a four or five-plex development on a standard lot is a lot easier when you're not trying to find where to fit the parking in.
So, Bill, related to that, type two appeals that come into this hearings room, Design Commission is the body that hears the appeal and makes the final decision. Neighbors to proposed developments frequently testify, and the majority of testimony focuses on parking and the impact that new development has on the surrounding streets and the existing neighborhood fabric. Streets are often very narrow, and you know, parking is hard already, and then a large development comes in and it makes it that much harder for all parties. So this better housing by design code increases density and reduces parking, which means we're going to have a lot more testimony in this hearings room. And it would be great to have a short list of BDS's talking points on this so that we can represent to the public exactly what BDS's thinking is on reducing parking in these zones.
Sure.
At the same time, the development potential is being increased at all of these sites.
We can come up with something. I think generally there's, with the city leadership, there's been a greater prioritization placed on providing space for housing opportunity than space for parking. And especially on small sites, which are the majority of our multi-dwelling zone sites, that's especially where you have that tension. Trying to fit four or five parking spaces on a 5,000 square foot lot is just plain difficult to do, especially given some interest in these middle housing types, which once you're putting parking in, you're almost forced to go to three stories with a lower level parking.
Absolutely. And absolutely, it has a huge impact on the surrounding neighborhood.
But yes, it's an ongoing topic. One thing we are proposing related to that is the other end of things, in that we're proposing to limit paved vehicle areas to being a maximum of 30% of site area, so that it's always a minority of the site area. And this is related to climate action plan goals we have for reducing urban heat island impacts. In East Portland, you're often starting out with a fairly green landscape situation, and moving to the project that's outlined is not going to help turn the dial down in terms of the urban heat island impacts. So we're proposing a 30% cap. Something that is maybe even more substantial is a proposal we have to limit blacktop or asphalt to 15% of total site area. And that's because of analysis we had done with the Institute for Sustainable Solutions at PSU, looking at what kind of materials have the greatest impact on raising temperatures, and blacktop tended to be the greatest one. Blacktop intensive projects, their modeling showed up to a 5% increase in temperature compared to a typical neighborhood situation. So the 15% cap would amount to this hatched area. And this also represents a maximization of that 30% total parking area. So it would probably mean having to do a combination of drive aisles and blacktop and some other material. It's also open to permeable pavers as being part of that, which could help meet stormwater management requirements.
Do you still need to be within X amount of feet of a transit center or a transit street? 500 feet, I think, is the...
This provision would apply across the board.
So if you're more than 500 feet away, would you then have reduced parking capability, or would you just have to add more landscaping?
You would have the change down to a one space per two unit on large sites allowance. And for small sites, 7,500 square feet, we would not require parking, even if you're not ready by transit. We have some other policies or proposals, rather, related to building design, how it relates to the pedestrian context and common neighborhood context. One issue is that we have a lot of design policies, as you know, that talk about the public realm and a strong orientation. And the image of in the left is from one of our community documents. But there's a bit of a gap between those aspirations and what gets built. We have almost no limitations right now on front garages for attached houses or multi-dwelling development. We're proposing a limitation where front garages and structured parking would be limited to 50% of the building frontage on a primary street front. And where parking or where alleys exist, the parking would be required from the alley. One issue we're exploring right now is in our proposal, we had an exemption for tuck-under parking, where it's more a raised basement level, where it's tucked below a primary level with an entrance and living space, as a bit of a compromise where it allows some front garage situations, but help to limit the visual impact. However, we're currently under discussions about this, so there's some possibility of entirely preventing any sort of exception from the 50% limit. And so if you have any thoughts on that, that could be useful. Multi-dwelling zones have no street-oriented entrance requirements for multi-dwelling development. We're proposing to require front-oriented entrances and also providing an allowance for entrances that face onto a courtyard that connects to a public street.
What do you do on corner lots?
It would only have to orient to one front edge. We also have some proposals related to front setbacks. One topic that's come up is that in our higher density R1 and RH zones, there's little or no front setback required. And you do have situations happening where things are built at grade with windows quite close to the sidewalk, and you have that eyeball to eyeball situation between indoors and outdoors. There's also a concern about, in some cases, about community context, where often front landscaped areas are part of the character of areas. We're proposing in the RM2, the former R1 zone, and the RM3, the smaller scale RH zone, a 10-foot setback for the fronts. And this is intended to help ease the transition some between, well, the fact that many of these areas, single family houses are still fairly predominant. The idea of front landscaping could integrate that greater scale with some, at least some of the characteristics of the communities. We are looking at other cities. Vancouver, BC is an example of a place that typically has more of a landscape frontage situation off of the commercial corridors. We would be providing allowances where if adjacent buildings have a smaller setback, such as many of the older neighborhoods, you could match that setback for a context sensitive approach. Also, we'd allow for small or no setback for ground floor commercial situations. And also, if you're doing a raised ground floor, you could come up within 5 feet of the front property line, more along the lines of the historic example. So less landscaping, but at least you're addressing some of the privacy, the interface issues at the ground level. So that changed to a 10-foot front setback, which has actually been a contentious topic in some circles, would primarily be affecting the old R1 and smaller scale RH zones. For the bigger scale 4-to-1 RH zone, the new RM4 zone, we are proposing a 5-foot setback, but with an allowance if you raise 2 feet above grade that you could come up to the sidewalk. And that's in response to some city design review staff concerns about that interface between the streets and the units. It also would be consistent with what we did for the mixed use zones. Another thing we're looking at is revisiting our side rear setback situations. Currently in the multi-dwelling zones, the side setbacks, for example, vary from 5 to 14 feet based on the size of the building. And that compares to a standard 5-foot setback you have in the single dwelling zones. And these diagrams are contrasting the single dwelling zone on the left with a same scale development in a multi-dwelling zone. This is showing 30 feet, 60 foot long building. That same building would require an 8-foot setback. And talking to some affordable housing developers, they're saying some of the small sites they've been looking at are very difficult to develop because of the setback requirements. If you're going any bigger than this 30 feet, it's in many cases up to an 11-foot setback, which really squeezes that housing opportunity on these small sites. However, for larger buildings more than 55 feet tall, we're proposing a greater setback of 10 feet. And that, I should mention, also corresponds to where the community design standards can no longer be used and you have to go through discretionary review. So if there are issues with a 10-foot setback, modifications could potentially be processed through design review. Those small setbacks, it is probably a touchy topic among some. But one thing we'd notice in looking through some of the older neighborhoods like Buckman or Northwest is you can go down a street and you have the same pattern of compact buildings on small sites with relatively small setbacks. And so that small setback pattern allows some of that integration with the community patterns. A 10-foot setback, for example, would on a 5,000 square foot lot squeeze the building to being just 30 feet with a 20-foot gap between adjoining buildings, which is nothing like the historic patterns. In our discussions, people also felt it was more important to prioritize central courtyards versus that perimeter setback area. We're also proposing, to be consistent with the mixed-use zones, a requirement for height step-downs adjacent to single-dwelling zones, where height would be limited to 35 feet within a 25-foot distance of the single-family zones. Another carryover from the mixed-use zones project, and I know this was of some contention with the Design Commission, are requirements for larger buildings to have 25% of the facade offset from the primary elevation, a facade articulation requirement. And for the current R1 zone, that would trigger for buildings more than 35 feet tall. In the RH-type zones, that would trigger for buildings more than 45 feet tall. And that addresses community concerns about what some consider to be overly blocky buildings. But interested in your thoughts on this one. We have several standards related to East Portland, and this is that map I was mentioning that maps out the East Portland boundaries. And this is related to an analysis of the blot and the lot and block structure of these places. These are areas typically have much larger blocks and larger, deeper lots than the inner neighborhoods. The Roseway, for example, shown here, actually Rosewood, sorry, near 148th, the blocks are typically 600 by 1,000 feet long. And so this little square here is basically the same as a downtown block, so a very different scale. And a major lack of street connectivity. And when we talk to East Portland people as to what features they would like to see in multi-dwelling development to be more reflective and more of a positive contribution, they highlighted a number of things. One was about common open space areas. And this is partially because there are a lot of families of children there. It's also a very diverse community, and they felt things that could be gathering places, bring people together, was really important for new development. Douglas firs are part of the landscape over there. Front setbacks they also saw as important. They had less of a desire, especially in the residential areas, to be very hardscape. And another topic is related to mid-block open areas. The blocks are much larger in East Portland, and one positive aspect is it could provide opportunities for a situation where there's an opportunity to keep more of the middle of the blocks less built up. And when we shared examples from other cities around the world, there's some interest in these perimeter block models where even at higher densities, there's often a continuation of the green elements. Current example in projects in East Portland very typically fill out to the very back of the lot. So it might be just a moderate level of density, but very little substantial green area. And we're proposing a rear setback equivalent to 25% of the depth of the site. And that would be a major change from the way our regulations currently work. It would push development to be at least attached, if not multifamily, versus the more spread out single family type development. This is a topic we also are continuing to have community discussions about because there was not 100% consensus on it. Some pointed out that some of the well-designed examples there, like by some of our CDCs, had more central open space that was surrounded by residential units and very convenient. So there's a little bit of a trade-off between do you want the outdoor space to be central to all the units or contribute to a larger whole of a less built-up mid-block area. If you keep 50% as a setback, that could mean 100% clear area, or not 100%, 100-foot clear area. Those mid-block areas are often where the Douglas firs are located as well. Another issue with East Portland are a lot of the lots were platted out in a very narrow, deep configuration. These are showing lots that were 60 feet wide by 300 feet deep. So you're very typically getting these almost railway car type configurations. And some of the issues with that are you always need a 20-foot driveway, especially when you're not right by a street frontage in most cases. And that gobbles up a large amount of site area in these narrow sites just to accommodate back out for vehicles. There is virtually no space for street connections on these narrow sites. Little orientation to public streets with those configurations, a little usable space, outdoor space, or space for substantial trees. And you miss out on some efficiencies of scale. What we're proposing in some of our center type areas in East Portland is to set a minimum street frontage requirement of 90 feet. And this is intended both to promote better site design, where you can get away from the pretty predictable outcome on 60-foot wide sites, and would allow for better site design options. It would also provide space for street connections or partial street connections when they are needed. And this would apply to deep sites more than 160 feet deep. It would be a big change because it would make it difficult to develop an individual 60-foot wide site. But it's seen as something important for really improving some of the outcomes in that area of the town. Where that would apply are these mapped areas here, which mostly correspond to mapped center boundaries, except for the Division Midway area, which corresponds in part to PBOT's Division Midway street plan. And this would apply to the multi-dwelling zones within those boundaries. So you'd have to have that 90 feet of street frontage. There are exceptions for a plan development review and when a site is surrounded by already developed sites that are meeting minimum density. Going along with our approach to encourage more street connections is a change to the way we calculate development allowances. Currently, the development allowances are calculated after street dedication. And in East Portland, for example, a situation we get is very commonly when development happens, you get a stub of a driveway. It may even look like a street, but it's not a right-of-way dedication, and there's no development penalty for that. But once you're dedicating street for a connection, that gets reduced, taken away from your development allowance. And we're looking at changing that so the development allowance is calculated prior to the street dedication to as one measure to reduce some of the disincentives to getting street connections in. PBOT is also developing some approaches for narrower types of street connections that could work in more situations in East Portland. And they're also looking at a hierarchy of street connection approaches that create more steps between a full street connection and no street at all. That's part of our really trying to think more holistically about those development outcomes. One other thing, and this is related to the parking impacts, is in the mixed use zones project, we adopted a requirement for transportation and parking demand management approaches for developments close to frequent transit that add 10 or more units. And PBOT has a pre-approved set of TDM approaches that include multimodal financial incentives that would require a fee of $1,100 per unit, which is equivalent to a TriMet pass. And that fee would, once residents move in, would be applied to TriMet passes, bike share or car share type programs. That'd also be an education and outreach approach. So that in part is intended to address the whole parking issue of encouraging alternative ways of getting around beyond car ownership and car travel.
Is that an annual fee?
I'm sorry?
Is it an annual fee or a one-time fee?
That would be a one-time fee. I'd have to admit that what I've heard from some neighbors are things we couldn't do. Some have said if in areas where we're not requiring parking, we should not allow residents in no parking situations to own a car. But that's not something we'll be able to do. PBOT has some residential parking permit programs that could be used in areas where it's needed. So it's this, along with the other parking regulations and PBOT's approaches, are intended to be part of an overall approach. So where we are again now, just to recap, we have our discussion draft out for review. We're taking comments in through March 19th. Proposed draft expected by May 2018. We're during that time, we're also going to be undertaking a growth analysis to look at how the zone changes might be changing where growth could likely happen. We'll also be doing a transportation analysis to make sure there aren't infrastructure issues related to any of the zone changes. And we will be going to Planning Sustainability Commission for hearings in June. And so we're certainly welcome to receiving any comments you might have at this early point, but comments are also possible, of course, for Planning and Sustainability Commission. So that's the end of my presentation.
So thanks very much, Bill. Commissioners, if you have questions, please keep them very brief.
So PBOT charging $1,100 for essentially, I guess, bus passes, will that cost also apply to affordable housing projects?
My understanding is their current proposal would be to apply across the board to affordable as well as market rate units.
So the information that has circulated, I received a mailer from PBOT about this a couple of days ago. The information that's circulating states that there will be a lesser fee applied to affordable housing units, but it does not quantify that lesser fee. And I think that's because TriMet may not yet have a dollar value assigned to an affordable, it would be considered an affordable TriMet pass.
Yeah, I mean, I'm dealing with that right now.
Yeah, so. Right. It's potentially a huge ding to the pro forma.
Yep.
I quantified it on a couple of projects, and
it's almost
unmanageable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it's parallel with that PBOT effort, but any comments you have in that would be welcome.
I'm going to share them with everyone.
Yeah, and this would definitely be a new thing. I should mention that it would not apply to the lowest scale zone, the RM1, because those zones very typically have a townhouse or detached house projects where it's harder to administer those programs unless you have a building manager. So it tends to work better in the larger scale zones. But that's definitely something we would want to hear about, any concerns about that, because our overall objective is to reduce barriers for creating the housing that we need.
It seems to me like number 10, reduce parking requirements, and number 21, require transportation and parking demand management approaches, are really one conversation and not two.
That's probably a good point. It could make sense to group those two together.
And that attached to that is a whole kind of cross-platform approach to shared vehicles and all of that, electric call on vehicle on demand and everything, where all of that is going in the future. electric plug-ins that are shared. So I think there's a broader look at that could help your goals.
That's a good point. That is something we could identify.
I mean, rental bikes, it's like, okay, how's everyone going to get from everywhere, and how can we reduce the amount of land that it takes up? That's all that stuff comes under it.
Right. Those are important topics. You know, one thing I should mention too, even as we reduce the required parking, there is the market dimension where, for example, near 148th, right by the light rail station, almost all the projects there are including parking, no parking is required in those areas.
Right.
But it's perceived by the developers as something that's needed.
That they have to have, but the time will come.
Right.
So thinking about that as a bundle. And then my second comment was, how did we get to number 8, allow alternatives to conventional landscaping?
It was related to feedback we got that our approach to landscaping was somewhat dated, and that we should, if anything, be encouraging some other approaches that currently aren't allowed to meet the requirements. As I mentioned, if you were to do a raised courtyard, say above a parking podium or something, the landscaping in that raised courtyard would not count at all towards landscaping and was seen as allowing that. We had a very common townhouse approach, for example, is where you have a central driveway court that's basically a dark channel that provides access to the garages. And a developer did want to cap that court and have some of the landscaping be there. And he ran afoul of things for two reasons. One, the cap counted against lot coverage limits, and two, none of the landscaping on that cap could count. And this is seen as something that just provides a bit more flexibility for those configurations. Also to encourage eco roofs. It's not a one-to-one ratio in which eco roofs would count towards landscaping. I think our proposal is you need 4 square feet of eco roof for every 1 square foot of required landscaping. But it is intended to be at least an initial foray into encouraging more a broader range of approaches. Some have pushed us to do something more like Seattle's Green Factor. We didn't, within the scope of this project, have the ability to develop something so far-reaching as that, but we did want to create some provisions where some more recent innovative type approaches could count.
I guess I'm going to be a minority voice here, but I'm totally opposed to it. I think that those eco roofs, raised courtyards, and stormwater planners could be in the bonus portion of things. But as we get to be a denser city, every square inch of green and open space is going to be critical, not only to the people who live in those buildings, but the people who walk around those buildings. And so I don't want to see any reduction of that kind of lush greenery and landscaping go on the roof.
Is landscaping currently described as a percentage of site area?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's all tied into denser development, more intense development on the site?
Yeah, it varies by zone. Like the RM1 zone would be a 30% landscaping requirement. RM2 is 20% landscaping. And there's an overlap, but it's somewhat different with the required outdoor space. Landscaping, as it currently is in the books, it can be in the form of tiny fringes around these structures. So very often in East Portland, for example, that 15 or 20% landscaping is very small slivers of landscaped area. We're hoping that the 10% common area requirement could get us to larger chunks of what could be green area.
It's just for me, stormwater and eco roofs are not landscaping. They're engineering, civil engineering. So I think it's all great. I think it's a good idea, but I hate to see it take the place of actual landscaping.
Yep. Thanks for the comments.
Yeah.
I have a couple of questions that should be very easy. Is there an exception for the visitable requirement for grade conditions, site grade conditions?
There is one for very steeply sloped lots.
Okay.
I think it's like 20% grade, very steep, but generally it would apply.
Okay, and then my other question is, what is the for facade offsets, what is the depth? Is there a depth requirement of those offsets?
It's only a, we're using the same standard in mixed use zones, which is just a 2-foot offset.
Okay.
So not a whole, not a very great recession or a projection.
Okay. I was curious about the bonus section. Have you done any economic analysis to find out if, in fact, anybody will ever be able to use any of those bonuses, or if they're just on paper?
Well, actually, another thing that's currently happening and will be released by the proposed draft period is we're having an economic analysis undertaken of the base and bonus FAR structure to look at the feasibility. So that will be available.
Quick question. The RH zone is being substituted by the RM4, but that's only outside the central city. The RH still exists within the central city in the new comprehensive plan?
Not sure. The RH would, I believe, entirely go away. That everything that is an RH that's mapped as a standard RH zone would go to RM3, and then things mapped as a 4-to-1 RH zone would go to this RM4.
Throughout
zone.
The city.
Yes. One thing I should mention is that almost none of these proposals would apply to the RX zone, which is the primary multi-dwelling zone in the central city and in Gateway. I said that none of the required outdoor space or common area things would be required in those areas.
So, Bill, as the D overlay expands, community design guidelines will apply in those areas?
In most cases, it would be outside the central city with the community design guidelines and the community design standards.
So how does the rollout of Better Housing by Design work? How does that roll out adjacent to revisions to community design guidelines? What's the timing on those two things? Are they aligned?
I'm not exactly sure when the expected effective date for the DOZA design standards or design guidelines are. I know for this project, the earliest anticipated effective date would be January of 2019.
Okay. And Laura has an answer to the other side of that question.
You could speak in this one.
Okay, thanks, sorry. Laura Lillard, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. To answer that question about when the design guidelines would be in effect, it's probably about 2020, so there will be probably a year lag.
Thanks for answering.
I have another question about FAR. So how does the inclusionary housing dovetail with the FAR bonuses under this program? Because you have some incentives, obviously, to 50%.
Yes.
But you're allowed 3 FARs if you do a full inclusionary housing under the inclusionary housing program.
The current inclusionary housing program, it effectively is a 25% increase beyond the base FAR. So we would be expanding or increasing that FAR increase.
If you're in an RH zone in an FAR, if you're in an RH zone in the central city, you're allowed to do 3 FARs in addition.
Oh, I should mention that these FARs I'm talking about and the increase
outside of the central
city. Outside central city. Sorry for not clarifying. Almost all these provisions are really just outside the central city.
So does the RH and RM3 and RM4, if they're in the central city, behave differently?
Any RH zoning, but I think there's very little of it, I'll have to confirm, would be subject to these standards except as modified by the plan district. One issue with the central city is it has a vast array of plan district specific regulations. So any central city type provision that overrides the base zone would still apply.
Okay. I have one more question, sorry. The page 39, the access on the deep lot, have you guys checked this with the fire department?
We have been in conversations. I think we have another meeting planned quite shortly. But if anything, I could only imagine it helping because they have issues with properties that are more than 150 feet deep and have further than the hose distance from the curb.
It's just that your plan on the 120-foot wide section seems like it gives you access to certain buildings and not access to others. So I was wondering if that was vetted with them, because you might end up having them requiring a fire lane around the site.
Yeah, we'll definitely be, we have them as part of our technical advisory group.
Okay.
Great. Bill, I have a handful of thoughts about the affordable housing issues, which are not germane to design commission. So if it's okay, I'll give you a call tomorrow with some feedback on that stuff.
That'd be just fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. I think we are done with comments and questions. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Thanks for your time.
And great graphic. Very
really
simple.
Clear.
Yeah, really helped make difficult stuff a little easier to understand.
Okay, so. I'm glad it helped. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we will take a 5-minute break.
Can I just check in real quick?
Yeah, Hillary.
I don't know if the commission wants to provide formal comments at this stage or if you'd prefer to wait until the proposed draft is out. They would need comments by March 19th.
It seems like we need to have, there are a lot of comments and a lot of questions on a lot of different topics. It seems like we all need to have a conversation about it before we
and make the high
do
points.
That. Yeah. But
we'll take that up
the
at
schedule
another time.
Will be an issue doing it before the 19th.
Yeah. We've got a couple, I think we've got a couple other obligations in between now and then as well.
Yeah.
So maybe the thing to do is to plan on providing testimony in advance of any trips that BPS will make to Planning and Sustainability Commission.
Okay.
If we could...
We can be well organized by then.
Yeah, because it'd be great, too, if we have questions, if we can just send them all together.
Okay. Well, they won't be before Planning and Sustainability Commission until June.
Right.
Okay.
Do you think we need to do it before...
I mean, this is the earlier stage, if you want to get... If you have major concerns, you'd probably want to...
Could we get
them
in
now?
Could we do bullets now and then really weigh in when we need to later with the kind of narrative that's required, but
yeah.
Just kind of highlight some issues that would be easier to get done in time?
Sure. And my suggestion would be for maybe one person to take that on and then have it be an items of interest topic at a later hearing for you guys before
Perfect.
The 19th.
Okay, we need a volunteer.
Doing the guidelines.
If we discuss it at the next items of interest,
yeah,
and okay, I will be there.
Okay,
so I can
right.
write those down.
Yeah. Thanks, Jessica.
Great.
Thanks.
Fantastic. Okay, so we are going to take a brief break, 5 minutes.